spent a fair amount of time in Ezekiel, but I hope with good reason, considering it has 48 chapters. But as we get on now into Ezra, I'll give a briefer description of what we find in the book of Ezra that focuses on the temple. A different temple than the one we see in Ezekiel. We call this the second temple nowadays because Solomon's first temple had been destroyed. The people had been brought away into exile into Babylon. And so the theme of the book of Ezra is restoring the temple. And then also put, and people. Because it doesn't do any good to just restore the temple, but the people end up staying in paganism, and that doesn't work at all. We find a glimpse of what the book is about in Ezra 9, verse 8. When Ezra prays, he laments on behalf of his people, and he says, "For a brief moment, the Lord our God has been gracious in leaving us a remnant and giving us a firm place in his sanctuary. And so our God gives light to our eyes and a little relief in our bondage." He's thanking God for bringing the people back to the land. And God began restoring his rule via Zerubbabel, we see in chapters 1 to 6, because God used Zerubbabel to help restore the temple. But then God also began restoring his rule via Ezra in chapters 7 to 10, because Ezra had a key part in restoring the people. And those are the two major divisions of the book. So the restorations of the temple and the people to the land under Zerubbabel and Ezra record God's faithfulness and his mercy in fulfilling his promise of restoration to encourage the remnant in true temple worship and covenant obedience. You remember that Jeremiah said that the exile would last for 70 years. And then the people would be brought back to the land. We see the fulfillment of that promise through Jeremiah in the book of Ezra. And this is God demonstrating his covenant loyalty by restoring the remnant to the land. So God's covenant loyalty seen in restoring the covenant, the remnant to the land must be shown among the returning remnant in temple worship. Holy living also to keep David's line pure. That would be the natural response for them as covenant people. God has shown his covenant kindness to them. Well, isn't the natural response to say to the Lord, "I want to worship you"? Isn't it the same for you and me? Shouldn't our natural response, with all that God does in our life, to be to want to worship him and then also have a pure lifestyle as a result? So in regard to redemption, faithful to his promise to restore the nation, God brought the exiles back to the land so that a redeemer might be born there. They actually take a very severe step at the end of the book of Ezra in order to make sure that the messianic line would be intact. When the people have gotten involved in intermarriage and they have, in the words of Ezra, mixed the holy seed, they were actually destroying the possibility for the Messiah to come back. And so they took a drastic action of divorcing these 100-plus women that they had married. And Zerubbabel's role in restoring the exiles to the land prefigures the work of his descendant, who will restore his chosen ones from a life of sin. So we see Zerubbabel fitting in as a type of Christ, actually. Who, and both of them were in the line of David, and they both are involved in restoring exiles, you could say it. Now, how does this fit in with Esther? We'll look at Esther in a different section or session, but the book of Esther actually fits right in the middle of Ezra, in the main divisions of Ezra. Not quite the middle, but I'm dividing it in chapters 1 to 6 that take place around 538 BC, when the temple is rebuilt. The people return to the land and they rebuild it amidst a lot of opposition, but they end up having a temple by the time they end that. Then, during a 58-year gap between chapters 6 and 7, we find the 10-year book of Esther. And we'll see that when we look at Esther in a different session. By the time we get to chapter 7, we're now jumping two generations later, 58 years later. It'd be like you writing about World War II. All right? Now, any of you fight in World War II? I don't think anybody here fought in World War II, right? Maybe you'd be writing about your parents or your grandparents fighting in World War II. My father was in flight training in World War II. He was approved to be a fighter pilot 3 months after World War II ended. So he never did get to fight in World War II, but he was part of that whole group of Navy pilots who were getting trained. I wasn't there, but I could write about it, and I've read about it, and it would be like me writing about my father's time like that, and then jumping 60 years later to now, 70 years later, and now writing about my own present time. That's basically what Ezra is doing here. And in Ezra's time, he saw that even though the people had the temple, they still needed a revival. They still needed to become covenant people. So he brought a smaller group of people, 5,000 with him. That's one-tenth of what Zerubbabel brought. But they were important people. They were Levites. They were priests like Ezra. And God used them to bring about a restoration to the people that were there in the land. And it mainly came about through them separating themselves from the pagans. They had intermarried in chapter 9, and thus our key verse. And so those divorces were carried out. But the focal point in the book of Ezra is temple work. So that's the focus of Huddleston's acrostic. Why would they need temple work? Because the people need to be worshipful. It's not that God is just so enamored with temples. God provided the temple as a place where he could be worshipped, as a place, frankly, where he could be indwelling this building. It was a palace. We talked about that earlier. The word for temple and palace are the same. So when Israel built a palace / temple, they were inviting God to live among them. Now, in this case, we don't see the glory of God actually coming to the temple there at Zerubbabel's time. But what the Lord did do is the Lord truly did restore them to the land, as he said. So why does he restore us? Well, we saw these two 70-year exiles that Jeremiah had promised that both the people and the temple would be restored after 70 years. So I think to answer, you know, why does God restore us? Part of the answer to that would be he promised that he would restore it. That's why he restored them. But why did he restore them? God delivered the Jewish exiles to worship him. That's the focus. So the book of Ezra is really a book of worship. So don't let your focus just be on the temple. Think a little bit deeper as to why God wanted there to be a temple rebuilt. The issue is not brick and mortar. The issue is one of worship. So this is how I sum up the whole book of Ezra. God delivered the Jewish exiles to worship him. And it's a similar thing for us. For us, Ezra, for us, is that God delivers us from our bondage to worship him. Think about what we're going to do when we get to be with the Lord forever in heaven. What are we going to do? It's going to be mostly worship, right? We're going to serve him forever. We're going to serve him through worship. So I think that really the idea is that God transforms exiles into worshipers. And every one of us should have the goal to truly be a worshiper of the Lord. I don't know what you want to do best in life. I mean, if you have one skill or one passion that can exceed every other passion, what would it be? To be the very best mother possible, father possible, husband possible, wife possible, the best counselor you could ever be, the best preacher of God's word, the best teacher of God's word, the best evangelist. I mean, there's all kinds of passions that we could have, I think, that are honorable to the Lord. But what if we saw God transforming us into primarily being worshipers? We truly worship God. Don't you think those other things would fall into place? Don't you think you'd be a far better spouse or parent or friend or counselor or teacher or whatever? Sometimes it dawns on, let me tell you the quick story of what happened when I came to Singapore. My family was new. We didn't know what church to go to. So, and there was no internet invented yet. Can you believe that I started teaching here before the internet? Back in 1991, I had a 4-year-old son and a 1-year-old boy. Where do we bring this young family to church? So I looked in the Yellow Pages. Do you remember those? There's these books of ancient, back in the dinosaur era, where they had these Yellow Pages. And I looked under church. And there was no entry for churches. I thought, I know there's churches in Singapore. In fact, there's hundreds of churches. So it's not under churches. So I thought, well, what would you look under? Churches. Religion. So I looked under religion, and there was no entry for religions. So I thought maybe they subcategorized it from Buddhists and Hindus and Christians. I thought, where am I going to find the entries for churches to find out where the address of these churches are? I don't remember how I actually came about, but I found it under P. Places of worship. And I thought, oh boy, I do not think like a Singaporean at all. I would never have thought to look under places. Places of worship, places of eating, places of massage, places of racquetball, places of, you know. I'm kidding. They didn't have all those other entries, but they had places of worship. And then they subcategorized it into Buddhist places, Hindu places, Muslim places, Christian places. That's where I found the churches. And I thought, but then it really hit me. Places of worship. I thought, wait a second. Places of worship. That's really what I'm doing. I'm not looking for a place of fellowship, primarily. I'm not looking for a places of teaching, places of the many things that we do as people who hold to a religion. And I thought, wow, the Yellow Pages has a better theology than I do. And I have a doctorate in Bible, you know? I need to learn from these people who do the Yellow Pages because they understand something profound here. That really what we're about is being worshipers. And it's the same for these other religions. Those people who go to the Hindu temple, they're worshipers, are they not? Those who go to the mosque, are they not worshiping when they go to the mosque? And the same for Buddhist temples, etc.? God really spoke to me on that. Here's my question for you. What would change in your life if your chief reason to live were to worship? What do you think would change in you? How would your priorities change? What would be different in your life if your perspective, let's say, just of going into corporate worship, was that you were going to church to worship more than you were to grow as a in your teaching or meet your friends. And all these other things are wonderful things. I hope you experience that at your church as well.
May I comment also, worshiping doesn't mean just going to church. It's really 24/7, just as Revelation.
You're right to say that worship is, and maybe that's one of the things that would change. if your chief reason to live were to worship, then you wouldn't just do it at church.
Because I learned that, wow, it's really individual. 24/7.
Yeah.
At all time, my role as a mom, as anybody, you know, so that's worshiping.
Wow. Amen.
Yeah.
Worship is something that we should be doing all the time. So that when you gather together for corporate worship, it's just a continuation of the worship you've had up to that point. It's just, it's different, and it's better, it's communal, it's community oriented, which is, we all, you know, we all need that. You can't just only have individual worship, we need both. But maybe that's one of the things would change for us. We'd see that worship is a lifestyle. It's not hopping off the bus or the MRT or the car and going on into a building. You know, restoration to God for repentant believers requires action. And that's what these people did. I think that's really the application here. What do we actually do? How do we actually change to catch the message of Ezra to be worshipful? It takes action. It takes attitude change, I think, as well. If we can change our attitude, then I think we'll change our actions that follow. I do believe that attitude precedes action. Should. What attitude do we need to have about our own experience of worship on an individual basis as well as corporately? The emphasis in this book is corporate worship, because that's why they designed the temple, for people to, the whole community to gather together. And that's why they had this corporate idea at the end that they need to get rid of their own individual priorities of, oh, I can marry whoever I want, even if I marry a pagan. That's a very individualistic type of thinking. You know, I like her. She's a pretty Moabite, you know? That's the thinking that a lot of these men had as they married Moabitesses or Ammonites, etc. And they needed to get rid of that individualistic thinking and think community-oriented and think about the big picture of what they were actually doing to the whole community. That was the action they needed to take. And I'm not sure what kind of action or attitude, you know, change you need to take, but I would encourage you to do it as the Lord would have you to do it. All right. Any of your thoughts or questions, further questions about Ezra?
Yeah. I just want to
Charmaine.
About the divorces. So they divorced because they felt convicted. But at the same time, it does affect the person they divorced, isn't it?
The divorce is a very, very serious sort of thing. Yeah. When we get to Ezra 9, we find that they had all this external opposition, and the internal opposition was to discover that some of them married Moabitesses, and they had to, in fact, Ezra ends up sitting on the ground and pulling hair out of his beard. I mean, that would have certainly gotten people's attention. And yeah, and so I'm forgetting what your question was. What was it? What was the question again?
Like, yeah, they did something wrong already.
Oh, that it would be, that they would...
Then if you divorce them, it's also wrong, isn't it?
The divorce would have, it would have impacted not only themselves, yeah, but these women.
And their children?
Some of them had children, it says. Right at the end of Ezra. What's that?
Boaz also married Ruth.
Well, there's a difference between Boaz's marriage to Ruth, though. Right? Do you see the difference? Do you see the difference between Boaz's marriage to Ruth? Remember Ruth 1:16? She said, your people will be my people, your God will be my God. Ruth was a former Moabitess who gave up all that heritage and took on the God of Israel and took on the language of Israel. She became an Israelite like Rahab did, would be another example. And that's what God wanted. God wanted Israel to have that kind of impact in the lives of others, and the others would become part of the community of Israel. In this case, this was not what actually happened, because it says that the people here were, the children actually were speaking the language of these other people rather than speaking Hebrew. So they ended up the very last verse of Ezra 10, all of these, I think it lists 119 men here, had married foreign women, and some of them had children by these wives. So to say some of them had children seems to indicate that most of them hadn't. But he wanted to take care of this problem very quickly. And so God did approve of this divorce. Or at least, well, the text doesn't specifically say God approved of the divorce. There's 113 men here. The men could have left with their wives and gone over back to Moab. But he's just saying you cannot be worship Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, and also stay among the Israelites. And the principle is the same for us here too. Can a person be a member of your church when the person's also a devout Hindu or a devout Buddhist or a devout Muslim? I mean, would you allow that in your church? I hope not. You really have to make a choice of whether you're actually going to abandon that former lifestyle and embrace Christ. Last month, we took away two people from our church who are still living in Singapore. They don't come to church anymore. We've made attempts to bring them back, and they don't want to come back. I mean, I can't have them worshiping whoever they're worshiping or doing whatever they're doing and just have them be part of our church. We have a statute at my church that if you don't attend for 1 year, then we take you off as a member. So that way we're unless you're a missionary or something like that, you know, living abroad. I think the idea is we need to keep our own life. We need to keep the community intact. So it's severe, very severe, but it was God working in their life in a way where they really need to, sometimes we need to take severe action, and Ezra is a really good example of it.